Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
I was there, and then the first tower got hit, and we were, like, you know, jostled all over the place. And then the Port Authority came on the loudspeaker, and they were like, hey, explosion in Tower 1. Things are being taken care of. Everyone remain where you are. Stay calm. And I was like, well, I'm going to go check this thing out. So I went downstairs, walked outside, saw all the pandemonium, and then about 5 or 6 minutes later, and then it just bang.
While you were standing right there.
Well, it was like underneath a giant overpass that was...
And all your coworkers were upstairs?
Yeah, but I don't know. I couldn't tell exactly where it went in, so I had no idea.
Right.
So I called up to the office, and they were like, it was pandemonium, like, we're on our way down. And then I just started fucking it.
Comedian Steve Ranazzisi on Mark Maron's podcast, WTF, talking about what he claimed was his experience on 9/11. Well, yesterday, Ranazzisi admitted he made that story up. We'll have that story coming up later. But first, the second Republican debate takes place tonight in Simi Valley. The GOP has Silicon Valley on its mind, though, when it comes to fundraising. According to a new analysis by the Los Angeles Times, the Bay Area beats out Los Angeles and Orange County when it comes to donations to Republican candidates. And a lot of that money is coming from tech leaders. But does the rest of the Valley like the Republicans' message? Joining us now is Melanie Mason, politics reporter at the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. And we're also joined by Julie Samuels, executive director of Engine, and that's a political advocacy group for startups. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Melanie, let's start with you. So this really does go against the conventional wisdom. You think the Bay Area, you think liberal, you think Orange County, you think Republican, but that's not what your analysis found.
That's right. So when our data team crunched the numbers of the campaign finance filings starting in January through June 30th of this year, that was really the thing that jumped out to us, was that the Bay Area had emerged as this very lucrative fundraising ground for Republican candidates. But of course, there's a caveat here, and the caveat is that there are just a handful of mega donors that are really sort of skewing the numbers here. And you'll see these multi-million or million-dollar checks being written by just a couple of major donors, and that'll really boost the Bay Area's presence for GOP candidates. It doesn't necessarily reflect a huge fundraising base in the area.
And who are those mega donors?
Well, at the top of the list is Larry Ellison. He's the co-founder of Oracle, and he gave $3 million to a super PAC, which can, of course, collect unlimited donations. There's a super PAC backing Senator Marco Rubio of Florida. Another major donor is Scott Bannister, who's an angel investor in Silicon Valley, libertarian-leaning individual who gave $1.25 million to a super PAC that backs Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky.
Okay. And so, Julie, I want to bring you in here. Going down the food chain a little bit in Silicon Valley, what do people think of the Republicans?
I mean, I think what we've seen in general is that we haven't seen the candidate in either party who's, I think, really taken advantage of the opportunity that the tech community presents. I don't think anyone's really resonated kind of with the rank and file tech community startup world, if you will.
And what are their issues? What do they want to hear?
Well, I think first they want to hear big ideas, right? They want to hear big, big ideas. And I don't think that right now they're really seeing that. They care a lot about immigration. They care a lot about net neutrality is something that we've seen that's still coming up. They care a lot about issues around the, you know, so-called gig economy. These are issues that this community cares about. And we haven't really seen any candidate kind of dive in. I mean, we've seen candidates talk about those issues, of course, but not presenting the kind of really big blue sky responses that would get this community all excited.
So what accounts for the fact that people like Larry Ellison are so enthusiastic?
Well, you know, listen, you're always going to see kind of people from who've done very well in business engage in politics. Like that's not, mm-hmm. There's nothing new there. And I think that's what you're seeing. You know, Larry and others like him, they've been involved in political giving for a long time. We've seen that on the Democratic side too. I think those numbers bared out during now President Obama, then candidate Obama's campaign, right? So I think that that is kind of par for the course, and we'll continue to see that because more and more people are making more and more money in the Bay Area.
Right.
So that's a trend that I imagine will continue. I think, you know, we see this across industry. It's just new right now. What's interesting, I think, particularly about this community is that by and large, I find this community isn't as loyal to party as other communities are. And I think they're more likely to switch parties if they think a candidate is exciting or presenting the right ideas. And I think that there's a real opportunity for all of the candidates to engage with people working in tech to really kind of think through what makes that community tick, what makes that community excited. And there's so many young people there. It's a really exciting place to be working. And I think that if the candidates focus on that, there's a lot of good work they could do.
Now, you hear a lot about the libertarian bent to Silicon Valley, to the workers there, that they would perhaps be interested in a candidate like Rand Paul and Melanie, but you didn't find a lot of donations to Rand Paul.
No, Senator Paul's donations were sort of boosted by this one individual, Scott Bannister, but we didn't necessarily see a huge outpouring of support. And I think that that reflects like the lack of groundswell of maybe from the rank and file, as was mentioned, that we're not necessarily seeing any particular candidate really resonating. Senator Paul has been out to the area several times, but I don't think that that necessarily correlates to dollars.
Julie, why hasn't Rand Paul resonated?
I think when Rand Paul first started coming to the Valley, he was making some inroads. I think people thought he was really going to be a different kind of candidate. There was, I think about a year ago now, a really long New Yorker profile on him that some might remember that kind of set him up as an iconoclast that I thought was going to make him resonate more with the tech, again, quote unquote, rank and file. But I think lately he's been running kind of a much more traditional political campaign. We haven't seen that. I hate to use an overused word, but that disruptor thing in the campaign. And so I think people have just kind of written him off as another politician.
And when people see Larry Ellison donating so much to one candidate, will that trickle down? I mean, Silicon Valley does have this culture of idol adoration. Will people then think, oh, well, if he's doing it, then maybe I should look at Marco Rubio? Or anyone else?
You know, it's a good question. You know, I think this is what I hope happens. I hope what happens is that people will look up to these funders and see that they're engaging in the process and not just blindly follow who they're giving money to, but use this as an opportunity to really engage in the political process, think about political giving smartly. I hope that that's what happens, but I think it remains a little bit hard to kind of predict.
And what about Carly Fiorina? She's a native daughter of Silicon Valley.
Yeah. Well, okay. So that's a tough one. And I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing her on stage tonight. So, you know, I think a little bit remains to be seen. But of course, she's already run for Senate unsuccessfully in California. Mm-hmm. So she didn't resonate last time. And she's taken some positions publicly on issues that tech really cares about. She's come out saying that she would undo the net neutrality rule. She's come out against patent reform, some other things that the tech community feels strongly on that I haven't been talked about all that much, but I don't think will sit well with people when they realize. But again, I'm looking forward to seeing her tonight. I think it should be interesting.
And Melanie, just quickly, Orange County, traditional GOP stronghold, but only giving, what, $1.6 million so far? How come?
Right. We've really not seen Orange County sort of become the orange or the red curtain that we typically see it be. And I think part of that is because this is such a crowded field that a lot of donors are just sitting and waiting to see how everything shakes out. There's not necessarily a desire to write a huge check if you don't know if your candidate is going to make it even to the next debate. So I think that that's a major factor. And of course, Orange County isn't the Orange County of 10, 20, 30 years ago. The demographics are changing. The racial and ethnic demographics, and also the political demographics. We're seeing a lot more no-party preference voters. Almost a quarter of the voters in that county are now not affiliated with any particular party. So I don't think it's really sort of the Republican stronghold that we all seem to think of it.
Okay, fascinating. Melanie Mason, politics reporter at the Los Angeles Times. Julie Samuels, executive director of Engine, a political advocacy group for startups. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Well, as we just heard, there is one candidate with a storied Silicon Valley history. Carly Fiorina will take the stage at tonight's GOP debate, which is at 5 o'clock on CNN. And the other candidates have already begun to attack her business record in the tech industry. I spoke earlier with Eric Hesseldahl. He's a senior editor at Recode about Carly Fiorina's history in tech and how that experience could help or hurt her candidacy. Well, let's talk about Fiorina's business background. She joined AT&T when she was 25 years old. She rose through the ranks to lead their hardware division, Lucent Technologies, and then she became CEO of HP in 1999. What were her business strengths?
Her business strengths, she really likes to take credit for leading the sales team at Lucent during a period when it was growing very rapidly. A lot of this growth occurred at a time when Congress had really deregulated the telecom industry, and so there was a rush to build out a lot of telecom capacity. Lucent was one of the key arms dealers to all these telecom companies that were challenging the likes of AT&T and older established companies like US West and SBC and Bell Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of competition there. But what was happening is that it was really unsustainable. Like any other bubble, there's always more supply than there really is ultimately demand. And that's what happened here. And what happened was Lucent was one of many vendors, and it wasn't alone in this. There were several others that were selling its equipment to companies that had no operational history. It's kind of like if you were buying a car from a dealer on a lot, and it's a $20,000 car, he loans you $20,000 to buy the car. Well, in this case, Lucent was doing something that the car dealers can't. Imagine if for a $20,000 car, the car dealer gave you $100,000 and you just banked the difference. Yeah. That's essentially what Lucent was doing.
And what was Fiorina's role in that? Did she lead those sales?
She led the sales force as Lucent's president, and she takes credit for heading up the sales force in her autobiography. So those are her words, not mine. And she would have been knee-deep and acutely aware of the way these deals were working. And so, but now, it should also be pointed out that these were not uncommon.
Yeah, and so she can rightly say it wasn't just her, but then she moves to Hewlett-Packard, and she's caught up in a similar problem where she instituted this merger between Hewlett-Packard and Compaq only to, you know, get caught up in the tech bubble burst and had to lay off, 30,000 people?
I grew up in an HP company town in Oregon called Corvallis, and a lot of my friends who worked for HP at the time came to know Carly as Carly Scissorhands. That was the unkind moniker they gave her because she was known for cutting these jobs. And so to that extent, she's remembered kind of bitterly for that period by HP employees.
So, Eric, was it the bursting of the tech bubble or was it her decision to do this merger? I mean, what's to blame for those massive layoffs?
The PC industry was going to consolidate, and I think HP's decision to acquire and take over Compaq had a lot to do with triggering that consolidation. You may remember companies like Gateway and eMachines and others. They were all absorbed by other larger companies, and so this was really the first in a long wave of consolidation in that industry, so it had to happen. But the one thing that Fiorina is remembered for is also really doing long-term damage to what's considered the HP way. And the company had a very distinct and unique culture that dated back to its founders. The company dates back to 1939. It was very egalitarian. The notion that no one has an office and worked in cubicles is an idea that really came early at HP. Everybody's ideas mattered. It was a very, very engineering-driven culture. And so a lot of those changes were brought on by the pursuit of what was essentially a commodity industry. PCs, you know, one PC or another, they're not that different. And so there was nothing really unique that HP was contributing in the technology sphere here. Their PCs were essentially, you know, the same, arguably, as the ones from Dell or any other vendor. And therefore, a lot of the value of the engineering expertise that HP had prided itself on for decades was being lost, and company morale suffered greatly.
So it's been 10 years since she left, and just today HP announced another 30,000 layoffs. So how has the company been doing since she left?
They've been struggling for 4 years, but now the new CEO, Meg Whitman, has decided that the best way to save HP is to split it in two. And so on November 1, it will become two companies. It'll be HP Inc., which is printers and PCs, and HP Enterprise, which is devoted to corporate computing and services.
Now, it's interesting that Meg Whitman is running HP now because, of course, she ran for governor during the same election cycle, 2010, as Carly Fiorina ran for Senate against Barbara Boxer. Both of them lost. Fiorina was trounced by Boxer, 52-42%. So taking all of this that we've been talking about, her tenure, her spotty tenure, as you've described at HP, and her loss to Boxer in the Senate race, I mean, how do you rate her candidacy now?
Well, there's no question that her candidacy has really gotten a jolt in recent days. She really shined in the so-called kids' table debate that Fox hosted last month, and she fought her way onto the main stage of the debate tonight at CNN. That was a story in and of itself that was very interesting. And then came the day that Donald Trump insulted her looks in an interview in Rolling Stone, and it turned out that may have been the best favor that Donald Trump could have done the Fiorina campaign, because what happened was the Fiorina Super PAC turned out a video ad on YouTube that was really pitch perfect, and you really have to see it to understand. But it was an ad that was designed to really appeal to women, which is not a traditional strong Republican constituency. At the moment. It doesn't say the word Republican, but it does call out the fact that, you know, Democrats really can't take women or shouldn't take women voters for granted. But it was really pitch perfect, and you can't walk away from it saying that it was a bad ad. It was a terrific ad, and it was a moment that was basically generated by a Donald Trump insult. And so in this sense, Carly Fiorina is right now the only candidate to now who has effectively punched back at Donald Trump. No one else has been able to do it. Well, what's really happened here is with Fiorina's candidacy, and here's what I think is so interesting, is that it was seen as sort of a vanity. She was Fiorina was going to be the Herman Cain of 2016, you know, the somewhat eccentric business person with a little bit of their own personal money who could go out and maybe have an interesting discussion, and then they would go away. She had effectively no support, no financial support. Her super PAC had raised maybe $4 million. Her personal campaign had raised maybe $2 million. That was it. No meaningful support from any of the billionaires that any of the other candidates have gotten. And now all of a sudden she is really rallying. The New York Times CBS poll that's out today shows that she is effectively in fourth place. Now you can argue exactly where she is, but she's effectively in fourth place in the same area as, you know, more establishment candidates like Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, and you know, well behind Ben Carson and Donald Trump, obviously. But you know, we have to assume at some point, and I honestly believe this, that Donald Trump's candidacy will cease to be a serious candidacy. I think it's being taken serious now because he's doing well in the polls, but he doesn't have any meaningful campaign infrastructure around the country. He doesn't have any major position papers. He's really not acting like a serious candidate in any meaningful way. He's acting like a reality TV star. So I assume he's going to go away, in which case the more establishment candidates are going to, you know, reassert themselves. And that moment will come when a Jeb Bush or a Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio will, you know, come close to winning the nomination, and then they'll start looking for a running mate. And I think Carly Fiorina stands a very meaningful chance, as it is today, of being named on the ticket. If that's assuming she does well in the debate tonight and that she holds her own in one of the primaries and or caucuses that are coming up next year.
Eric Hesseldahl, senior editor at Recode. Thank you.
You bet.
Well, here's something for the candidates to chew on. New census figures out today show that despite a good economy, median income has not increased for the last 3 years. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. New numbers from the census today are providing something of a reality check when it comes to the economy. Median income last year did not budge from the previous year. So that's 3 years in a row of zero growth. It's the same story with poverty. Around 15% of Americans lived in poverty in 2014, same as the last 4 years. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve is meeting today and tomorrow to decide whether or not to raise interest rates. Well, joining us now to connect the dots on the Fed and this new economic data is Charles Ballard, professor of economics at Michigan State University. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. Well, the headlines on the economy have been great recently. Unemployment down to 5.1%. GDP grew by nearly 4% in the second quarter. So what does this mean, that the median income is stalled out at around a little bit more than $53,000 a year?
Well, it's really a continuation of a trend that goes all the way back to the 1970s. Our economy is more than twice as large as it was then. But median income has not kept up. Most of the growth in the last 35 to 40 years has been at the top, and indeed an awful lot of it has been at the very, very, very top, the top one-tenth of 1%. So we've experienced an increase in income inequality that really, so far as the data show, it's not precedented in U.S. history. It's a huge increase in inequality, and it's been going on for a long time. So the data that you give of a growing economy but the average household is going nowhere, that's a story that's been going on for decades now.
Yeah. So while it's gone nowhere nationally, even here in the West, it's actually gotten worse. It's dipped, according to this latest statistics coming out of the Census Bureau, down by 4.6% in the West. Any speculation as to why?
Wow, that's a stunning number, 4.6% drop. I don't have a good story for why the West would be so different from the rest of the country.
Yeah.
Sorry, I wish I did. Have to chew on that one for a while.
Okay. I mean, it might have to do with immigration.
Possibly.
Immigrants not earning as much.
One of the things that appears to put downward pressure on the wages of some households is immigration. And we do have more immigrants in California than a lot of other parts of the country. Like here in Michigan, we have relatively few. So that could be part of the story. But so many things go into the income distribution. There's the degree of unionization. There's the tax structure. There's the education system, and whether it's providing the skilled workers to keep up with the technological demands of the economy. So there's a lot of moving pieces, but I think immigration could well be one of them.
And then we also have the stubborn poverty rate, which hasn't gone down at all, 4 years in a row unchanged.
And is about 4 percentage points higher than it was in 1973. So we really have a period now of 40 years in which the poverty rate has, if anything, gone up and certainly not continued to go down like it did back in the 1960s and early 70s. So those at the bottom of the income distribution and those in the middle, the poverty rate really talks about the bottom and the median income talks about the middle. Those groups have not done well in the United States for a very long time. If you get above the middle, if you get to the 80th percentile, the 90th percentile, the 99th, you're doing pretty well.
Can you break it down demographically? Who is doing the worst ethnically or by sex?
Well, it's interesting that there are cross currents because African-American households have actually, at least at the median, the average African-American household has made modest progress. Their household income is still way below the average white household, but they've made that gap has closed some in the last couple of decades. Women have made a lot of progress. So They have caught up, you know, back in 1970, in the mid-70s, the average woman worker made 59 cents on the dollar relative to the man. Now that number is in the upper 70s. Major progress. So the suspect that we would often think of when we see the rich doing so much better than the rest of the population, we might think that that would be a current that would be bad for women, but in fact, women have, in a sense, been swimming upstream. The increase in income inequality isn't as much a race thing and as a gender thing. It's more just that regardless of race or gender, those at the top and those at the very top have been done extraordinarily well.
Now, we mentioned that the Federal Reserve is meeting today and tomorrow to consider raising interest rates. What do you think would happen to what we've just been talking about in terms of median income if the rates are raised?
Well, the one thing to remember is that the Fed, although I think they pay attention to income inequality, their charge is to try to keep the economy close to full employment with relatively low inflation. So I'm not sure that the Fed factors these things in. Maybe they should factor them in more than they do. But I think to the extent that they are thinking about this, they might be cautious about raising rates. In fact, they've been cautious about raising rates for several years because the economy has been weak. The job market has been weak. It's finally getting stronger, but there's still a lot of people who are absent from the labor force. Wages are not rising very fast, barely keeping up with inflation. So if there's any danger that a rate increase would choke off this economic expansion, that would probably have its worst effects for those at the bottom, the low and middle income workers. And so those who are concerned about that are cautioning the Fed, be careful. Maybe hold off on a rate increase. And if you do a rate increase, I think it's likely to be only 0.25 point. And if they go up 0.25 point, they'll probably wait and see and see what kind of effect it has. Because I think this is not a good time to slam on the brakes.
Charles Ballard, professor of economics at Michigan State University. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. Has your economic situation gotten better since the recession, or has the economy left you behind? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how to get the richest people in Los Angeles to become more engaged with the city's civic life. It can't just be Eli Broad.
To try to engage the entire public and make the future of this city something that is for all of us, I think would be just a wonderful, wonderful thing and make people then love LA more.
Our series, Making LA, on creating civic engagement, after a news update with Jennifer Wolf.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand, and welcome to another installment of our series, Making LA.
LA, of course, is the kind of temporary city.
The punk rock attitude of LA.
Los Angeles is a desert community.
We used to build things in the San Fernando Valley.
What would it mean for downtown to work?
LA is not a pretty city except from the air.
City of tomorrow.
On Making LA, we've been looking at how we can improve the lives of Angelenos through issues like the built environment, transportation, traffic, homelessness, public spaces. But are we Angelenos really engaged, like New Yorkers or Chicagoans, in trying to make our city a better place to live? Do we feel connected to our city? Do we volunteer? Do we give money and support to our museums, our cultural institutions? Well, according to the Corporation for National and Community Service, last year, 62 million Americans volunteered, almost 8 billion hours of their time. But Los Angeles ranks near the bottom when compared to other big cities. We are 45th out of 51 cities in volunteerism. Then again, New York is number 50. Here with me to talk about these issues is Donna Bajarski, founder of an upcoming conference called The Future of Cities Leading in LA. Hi.
Welcome.
And full disclosure, I will be one of the panelists at that conference. Also, Wendy Guerin, president and CEO of the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation. That is a broad-based grant-making organization, also a contributor to KCRW's capital campaign. Hello.
Happy to be here.
Nice to have you. Well, Donna, your whole conference is about trying to get people involved, trying to foster a greater sense of civic engagement. So where do you think the big problem lies?
Well, we're not only trying to do civic engagement, we're trying to take it a step farther and looking at civic leadership, which is, I think, one of the problems in Los Angeles. Even the mayor has mentioned that the lack of that kind of civic fabric investment is one of his biggest challenges in trying to accomplish big things here. We don't have quite a culture of it, and we don't have bad weather that forces us to think of other things, and we are geographically dispersed. But what I say is that's no longer an excuse. In other words, we have to get things done. We have to be a world-class city. We have to have ambitions. We have to improve the quality of life for Angelenos. And for that, that's going to take leadership. And it's time that we really step up and look to be a city of the future, which we could be a real model for.
So even the mayor, who was our city's leader, is saying we don't have civic leadership.
Yep. He's grown up here, so he knows it as well as anyone, and now he knows it even more as mayor. I mean, he knew it as a city council person and president, and it makes it very difficult to get things done. You know, we have this spectacular promise of the LA River, but unless a lot of people pony up what will be hundreds of millions of dollars, it's not going to happen. And Pershing Square and philanthropy and economic inequality and education, none of those things can happen unless people are willing to step up with resources. And, you know, we're a city of great vision and ideas, but it has to meet resources. Otherwise, nothing is there for future generations.
Well, resources is sitting right next to you. Hi, Wendy.
Well, and, you know, in addition to representing the board of the Parsons Foundation as their CEO, I'm also the voluntary leadership of Southern California Grantmakers, which is a membership association, a vibrant association that's grown from 100 members to almost 300 members in the last 2 years. And it's of foundations, individuals, corporations, and government grant makers all coming together to learn, connect, and act. And I think that Southern California Grantmakers is a good example of sort of the latent civic leadership that simply needs to be organized to come into play.
So does it take, though, a few organized, committed, and very well-funded individuals, someone like an Eli Broad, but maybe more than just an Eli Broad, a Dorothy Chandler, that kind of person, a visionary who needs to kickstart the city into doing something? Or is it more about a collection, a constellation of individuals?
I think it's more about the constellation than it is about the charisma of just a couple of people. At the same time, charisma is a good thing. You know, we can look at the LA River again as an example. We have Frank Gehry stepping up as a volunteer for the last year, doing $1 million worth of pro bono work to bring this project along. His charisma, along with his brilliance, shines a light on the project that will help to catalyze people being involved with it. So really, in a way, it's the old takes a village. We need everyone to be involved. You know, you may have noticed the USC Dornsife study this week that came out. People are disaffected with government. They really don't believe in national or local government. The shocker is how disconnected they are from local government. But yet 90% of them thought that volunteering for nonprofits mattered. So what we have to do is figure out how to engage those troops, because mm-hmm. that's really, I think, where change comes from.
Because they
it's
don't
top
see,
down and bottom
they
up.
Don't see the effects of what of their vote. They don't see what it's doing.
That's right. So I think when we think about civic engagement, we need a much broader lens than our people voting, because I think there is a willingness to be engaged.
But you don't give up on the voting, right?
No.
You of course need people to vote. I do think that you need, particularly in a place like Los Angeles that very much is a creature of sort of media and collective coolness, that you do need to have some folks that are considered leaders. And we don't have a clash of civic elite or a competition between civic elite here. And that's frankly what builds cities. You know, it's
so it's a clash of egos. Like, I want my name on that.
Yes. I mean, it's not all altruism. You know, somebody said to me, it's a peer tax. You know, it's not an actual tax, but there's a peer tax, which is if you want to be important, you have to show that you are contributing. Here, everyone is willing to sort of play in their own silo and be important in their own silo and not care beyond that.
You know, I always think that it's important to recognize that public dollars are public, but private dollars for the public good are really special. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about private dollars for the public good. How do we make those private dollars really meaningful? 50 years ago, the corporate sector gave as much money philanthropically as foundations did. Today, the philanthropic sector doubles what corporations do. And corporate giving is largely in kind. So I think part of what we need to do is catalyze the corporate sector, not just on giving, but on volunteerism.
So aside from the LA River, give me an example of some, you know, big philanthropy that's happening. Mm-hmm. Right now.
I can talk about a couple of things. One is, of course, everyone was so saddened by the unaccompanied minors that were coming through Southern California mm-hmm. last year. Kind of pales in the face of what we're seeing in Europe, but nevertheless, tragedies. And collaboratively, led by the California Community Foundation, major foundations were asked to give to a pooled fund to address the needs of these children. And more than $1 million was raised really very rapidly to deploy for these kids that were in Southern California to meet their immediate needs. It's not something we could have done as individuals. We needed to do it together. Another example would be around kids in dependency, children who were removed from their families, who were then essentially the public's children. They're our responsibility.
Kids in foster care.
That's right. Kids in foster care. And we have not done a good enough job for them. When the Blue Ribbon Commission offered its recommendations to the Board of Supervisors to reform the system, it was unclear if the board was going to adopt those recommendations. And philanthropy stepped up, and 17 foundations wrote a letter to the Board of Supervisors, essentially demanding reform. And that's not writing a check. That's exercising our public leadership. You know, it's an underutilized muscle. I've been in this work for 30 years. It's the first time I've ever seen us do that. And I think when you start using the muscle, you can use it again. Mm. To me, that really speaks to the potential to not ignore the public sector, but exercise influence on it and work collaboratively with it to drive change.
I think the philanthropic work that Southern California Grantmakers is doing is one of the really positive signs, and there are those. But if you look at, you know, the entertainment industry, if you look at Silicon Beach, you know, they are still lagging behind in where they could be in terms of giving. So, you know, for instance, this event that we're doing, the Future of Cities in October, a lot of that is to sort of announce to the world that this is something that you need to be doing. And particularly looking at sort of younger, you know, people, whether 30s, 40s, even 50s, who are now stepping up and willing to do it. But I don't think we can sort of take it for granted. I think we have to both celebrate what is happening, but definitely provoke and challenge and make people realize how important, how fun it could be. Otherwise, you know, we could sort of go on the way we are, because you can live a very good life here in a way that you can't in other cities without doing too much.
And okay, so we've been talking about rich people getting engaged, people who have the means to do that, leaders. But what about just regular people? Because you mentioned Buffy Chandler. I mean, she was very effective in mobilizing the public to contribute a dollar, you know, reach into your pocketbook, give a dollar for the music center. How does that happen? How does it trickle down to engage everyone else?
Well, I agree with that completely. When I think about the LA River, I actually have a dream that there would be that kind of campaign. Not only would there be the big resources that could come in there, I dream about having an Ellis Island kind of campaign where, you know, you can buy, you know, your own little rock, and that people are, you know, engaged in churches and, you know, in synagogues and all over to contribute. Yes, we both have to do the leadership because, again, you know, Ciclovia is a great example. If it didn't meet big resources, it would have been a fabulous idea in Echo Park. Mm-hmm. But what happened is that, you know, you had Aaron Paley, who was a sort of master at that, and he was able to take a vision and that find the resources that could then, you know, make something that is now one of the most transformative projects in Los Angeles.
I also think that the fight over the LA Times and control over our paper is a huge problem for us. And really the arrogance of the Tribune in dumping our publisher, who was moving us in a direction of having that paper serve the public good locally. I am hopeful that leadership will step up and try to pry back our paper to be locally controlled one way or another.
Do you see a new generation of leaders in the wings?
There are absolutely people who are doing amazing things. Actually, one of my friends was profiled today in the LA Times named Matt Johnson, who's on the police commission. He is a great example of both now and future leaders of Los Angeles. They definitely are there. But the idea that we're trying to do is bring the industries and individuals and communities together so that they start to inspire each other, show them that by working together, not only will they have more fun, not only will they create better business, not only will they have better models for the rest of the world, they will, you know, one of the funny things about people in LA, a lot of people who were here didn't come from here. But here's the deal. No one's leaving. Where are you going? People are staying, and they have to realize that their future is here and their children's future is here. So therefore, their responsibility is to create the kind of LA that they want their children and grandchildren to see, because they're not going back to Minnesota, with all due respect. They're not going back to other places.
And Wendy, you're nodding your head emphatically.
I'm totally in agreement. Yeah. And, you know, we support public radio. We support Donna's conference, because you have to hold these ideas out. They have to be cultivated and nurtured. And I think the fun part is actually really important. It feels good to make a difference. It can be a very happy experience. It's not doom and gloom. It's in a way, it's an antidote to the powerlessness that we feel when we can step up and make changes happen. And there's tremendous power in it. And it's a matter of sort of unlocking the energy, because I think it's there and people are willing.
But when you have people who are, you know, running their business, they're maybe here in Silicon Beach and they're just, you know, trying to get that next tranche of venture capital funding, and they're just caught up in their world of making a buck and making the next great app, let's just say, how do you say to them, wait, step back and look at the larger picture? You need to make a contribution, because, you know, as you were saying earlier, they can live quite happily without doing this.
Well, I think Donna was really saying it's enlightened self-interest. We are not living in isolation from others. And if we don't take care of the whole, our own lives are diminished. And so I think it's showing businesses where their own business bottom line is affected if they're engaged in a civic way. It's not just to do good. It's not like art for art's sake. It's doing good because at the end of the day, we'll all do better.
All right. Well, thank you very much. You two are very inspiring. Donna Bajarski, founder of the upcoming conference, The Future of Cities, leading in LA, October 19th. Wendy Guerin, president and CEO of the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation. Thank you both.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up on the show, comedian Steve Ranazzisi lied about being in the World Trade Center on 9/11. Why would someone do that? Put themselves in the midst of a national tragedy? Well, it happens more often than you might think. That's next on Press Play.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. For more than a decade, comedian Steve Ranazzisi has been repeating a dramatic story about himself. He said that he quit his finance job in New York to pursue comedy after narrowly escaping the World Trade Center on 9/11. And the decision seems to have paid off. Ranazzisi stars on the popular FX show The League. He has a new special on Comedy Central this Saturday. He's the face of Buffalo Wild Wings, appearing in its commercials. One problem, though, his 9/11 story is not true. Ranazzisi admitted in a statement yesterday that he was not at the World Trade Center that day. He was working in Midtown Manhattan. He's not the first person to falsely place himself in the center of a national tragedy. Others before him have lied about being victims of everything from 9/11 to the Holocaust. So what motivates them? Joining us now to try to explain is Elizabeth Loftus. She's a professor of psychology and social behavior at UC Irvine and an expert on human memory. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, in a statement, Ranazzisi said his lie was a story told by an immature young man, and he doesn't know why he did it. But this was more, it seems, than a white lie. Here he is 6 years ago on the TV special Pauly Shore and Friends, talking about how he and his wife were both in 9/11.
The first tower got hit, and we felt it in the second tower. And
where was she?
She was what I thought. She worked on the 24th floor of the same tower. And I didn't know if she was into work yet because she had. I left before her. I went downstairs to see what's going on. I walk outside. I see the fire and everything. And then I watch the second plane hit the second tower. And then I ran.
Okay, so not only is that story not true, but his wife, then girlfriend, wasn't there either. But he's told this story over and over again. And Elizabeth Loftus, is it possible that he actually believed this?
From what I can tell so far, and again, this is just pure speculation based on media information and what he seems to be admitting, this was a 23-year-old young man who apparently made up a story, maybe to make himself sound more interesting, and then he got trapped in his story.
So kind of like Brian Williams, in a way?
Actually, I'd be more generous about Brian Williams. Brian Williams' story sort of evolved over the years from, I arrived after the other helicopter was hit to then I arrived and saw the other helicopter be hit, and then eventually my helicopter was hit. I mean, I would give him more the benefit of the doubt that was the evolution of a false memory. But this one seems like, and it seems like he may be admitting that he made it up at the start. Whether he ultimately started to believe it, it's hard to know without pressing him further or getting other information.
Yeah. And so does it often happen that people then do actually believe their lie, even if they set out at the beginning to deliberately lie?
Oh, yeah. I mean, deliberate lies can turn into what feels like your truth. And, we've shown that in our experiments. If you seduce people into deliberately lying in an experimental situation, they can ultimately start to believe that it actually happened. We just don't know if that's what happened in this case or whether it was a lie at the start and it remained a lie. He seems to have kept on adding detail that was, maybe destined to sink him. The adding, for example, that Merrill Lynch gave him severance pay when he left, when he apparently wasn't even working for them.
Yeah, and they weren't even in the Twin Towers. They had no offices in the Twin Towers. But, he's not the only one. There was another woman, Tanya Head, who lied about being a 9/11 survivor. There was also a woman who wrote a Holocaust memoir, which turned out to be false, and she wasn't even Jewish. What is the impulse then, do you think?
Well, then we can go way back and talk about all the people who confessed to kidnapping the Lindbergh baby. Sometimes there's a financial motivation. You get a bus explosion and sometimes more than five times as many people who could have fit on that bus are now claiming they were there and want some compensation. That doesn't seem to be the case here, but there are other motivations that get satisfied by the embracing of a false story.
And what are those motivations?
Well, just to feel more important, to be part of history, to be a more interesting person, to gain empathy or sympathy or other reactions from other people that are appealing. Those are the kinds of things that can motivate people to cling to false stories.
And are these people who typically do this a lot, or is it a one-time event?
There's probably a whole distribution where people might do it once or might do it many times. I think we can look around and see examples of lots of different people who've developed false memories that end up being kind of embarrassing for them. I don't think these people are deliberately lying. I think it's a lot easier to believe, for example, that Brian Williams, truly had a false memory than that he would make up a story when it was so easy for someone to check it.
Yeah, and he's in the checking business, so who would know?
Right.
But then you have people like Rachel Dolezal, who basically created a whole different person for herself, finding heroism in victimhood.
Oh, well, we've seen thousands of those cases of finding heroism in victimhood in all the false memories and false accusations that I've been involved with for the last 25 years. People who have developed beliefs and memories that they were, raped for 10 years in satanic rituals, that they were forced into animal sacrifice and baby breeding and baby sacrifice, all uncorroborated recollections, which then gain them victimhood.
And then what happens when you confront people with their story that you know is false? How do they react?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton reacted very well when confronted with a story that she was telling in 2008 about how she landed in Bosnia under sniper fire. When confronted with the evidence that it was a peaceful greeting ceremony involving children and flowers and her daughter was there, she said, I made a mistake. I had a different memory. That proves I'm human. And I think that's the best way to respond to something like that when you're confronted with the evidence that your memory is wrong.
So I guess Steve Ranazzisi is trying to do the same thing now.
He seems to, you know, Hillary said, I had a mistaken memory. Brian Williams said, I don't know why I conflated those two aircraft into that memory. The comedian seems to be suggesting that he knew he was lying. And he always knew, but I'm not sure of that. If you could get him on the program, I'd really love to know.
I don't think he's commenting right now.
Oh, well, maybe soon he will. He'll write a memoir of it.
Right, exactly. Elizabeth Loftus, professor of psychology and social behavior at UC Irvine. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Nice talking to you.
All right, that's going to wrap it all up for us in a nice, tidy bow. Hey, if you're checking out the debate and you want to check out our tweets, we will be live tweeting at KCRW Press Play is our Twitter handle. You can also tweet us with anything you want to say. Facebook, KCRW Press Play, or you can leave us a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Have a great afternoon. Warren Olney is up next, so keep it locked right here. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.